Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 12th of January. I read a newspaper clip about this some months ago, and we're very happy to have the author of The Moral Underground with us this hour, How Ordinary Americans Subvert an Unfair Economy. Our guest is the author of the book. Lisa Dodson is a professor in the Department of Sociology at Boston College, and she has a special interest in the areas of low-income work, poverty, public policy, and family life. And what she did was spend years and years talking with people all over the country, people who are having a hard time making it, who have children to raise, who may be single parents, who are in very low-wage jobs, can't really make a living, so they're having to put together childcare in such a piecemeal fashion for their children after work. You can't get sick because you might lose your job. And then what are you going to do? It's a story about those people, but also about employers who have gone out of their way, perhaps, to help these people out. The book is filled with stories of teachers, and teachers see this quite frequently. Students who may be homeless, students who are having a hard time in school because of what their family situation is. She highlights a school nurse who keeps cots in her office so that students in difficult family situations can sleep for a while. Lots of problems with health care, of course, people not being able to pay for insurance. And so doctors who are going out of their way to give prescriptions for or medicine for a whole family instead of just one person, people who will get prom dresses for an employee because the employee can't afford to buy one for her daughter. Just filled with those kinds of moral underground stories. What's good for business may not be good for most Americans, and particularly those who are struggling to make ends meet. We talk with Lisa this hour of the program, and I'm sure that you'll have some stories for us as well. She has worked as a union activist, an obstetrical nurse, and the director of the Division of Women's Health for the state of Massachusetts before becoming a professor of sociology at Boston College. She's also the author of Don't Call Us Out of Name. We'll be welcoming phone calls for you. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address, you can use that as well, talk@wpr.org. Hi, Lisa. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I love these stories. they're just great stories, aren't they? It's wonderful to know. And I don't think people know about this moral underground.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that was certainly one of the big motivations to put this, all these accounts, kind of string them together and tell this narrative, which to me is really a narrative of America, and it's the one we don't hear. We hear a lot about the corporations and greed, and that is real, and it's still going on. But there's also another story that I really felt need to be told, and yeah, I just love to listen to people talk about these issues and their own ethical reflections and the stands they're willing to take.
Mm-hmm. You spent years putting this book together. Tell me the process you went through and talk to hundreds of people.
Yeah. Well, so all together, there are five different studies that took altogether 7 years. And initially, my work has always been focused on low-income people who are particularly parents, moms who are working hard and raising their children and are not earning enough to make ends meet. And I've always wanted to hear that account so that try to raise it up, try to shine a light on it. So we see that that's really a big part of what goes on in low-income America. And in the course of this work, I decided that I wanted to not only talk with low-income parents and children and hear their vantage of what's going on in this country, I also wanted to talk to people who know them very well and know them because they are employers and they hire parents who are low income, or because they're teachers in school, as you pointed out, and or they work in the healthcare, in some part of the healthcare system. And so they, every day they see people who come to them who have health issues, but also who don't make enough money to make ends meet. And I decided I really wanted to hear that more middle-income people, people who themselves make a sustainable income. Some of them make a pretty good income, but they really see these kind of intimate daily lives. So I went out and I asked them as well. I went to places around the country, as you said, and asked a lot of different people to tell me what they knew. And what I discovered was that the story the middle-income people had to tell went beyond just the story of what they see, how they recognize the problem with unsustainable wages and low-income working families. They also wanted me to hear that this has a big effect on them, because people bring all of those problems with them every day when they come to work or they go to school or they go to the hospital. You know, they bring that complicated economic context with them. And some of these middle-income people found it very, very hard to stick to the rule book when dealing with people who just don't make enough money. It's not their fault. They don't set their wages. They just come with that problem. And then I discovered what I began to see as a kind of moral underground, and that was middle-income people who said, no, I'm just not going to be complicit with this. I'm going to bend the rule. I'm going to break the rule. I'm going to go about it a little differently and try to help people out just a little bit where they can.
Right. And more power to them. How often did you, the book has some of these stories, mm-hmm. but did you find more often than not that those were the kinds of people who are the employers, or did you find the, you shouldn't have kids because you're poor, you know, it's your responsibility. I don't care what your situation is. You get here to work on time or you're out the door.
Yeah. The large majority of middle-income people, employers, teachers, health people, but certainly employers, the large majority expressed the feeling and the belief that they would like to pay people enough so that they had stable lives, mm-hmm. and that people should make a living, not just a wage. If they're working hard, if they're doing the job, they should make enough to get by. And part of the reason I think that employers, this was the large majority, employers want this to be the case is, first of all, they just think it's fair, but also all of that insecurity is really hard for a business. It makes for problems every single day at the workplace. So the majority wanted it fair, wanted the people to have stable lives, wanted to pay people a living. There was a smaller group of people who not only felt that it was unfair, but that they were willing to break the rules. And then there was the smallest group, but they were very vocal, and they were the people, and I think they're the ones that we hear the most from, certainly in the large corporations and Wall Street, and they're the ones who say, you know what, I'm a business person, and anything I can do to make more money and, right. you know, send more money to my stockholders, whatever damage that does to the workers or the children of the workers or the community, because, of course, this all spills into the community, that's not my problem. Mm-hmm. That was a small group, but they're a big presence in the country.
Well, I'm glad you've added the other presence, because mm-hmm. it means that there's hope for change here.
Right.
You quoted, and I forgot about this quote from him, but it's one of the themes of the book from Martin Luther King shortly mm-hmm. before he died. It is criminal to have people working on a full-time basis getting part-time income.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Martin Luther King, I mean, towards particularly later in his, before he was assassinated, he had really moved a lot of his analysis of racial injustice. He really recognized that economic injustice is a central issue in this country, and one that had to be taken up.
Right. Tell us about the woman. I can't remember her name now, but you've used her in many of your stories, because sometimes it seems obvious to many of us, but sometimes people don't have an understanding of what it's like to be a single mom raising a couple children. They're in school. You've got transportation to deal with. You've really got after school yeah. things to deal with. And this patchwork that this yeah. one mom had to put together just to be able to work.
Yep. I call her Emily in the book. And, you know, I chose her story because it was hard to choose because there were so many accounts that were very similar to this. But what Emily and I did was we sat down one day, and as I say, I'd heard a version of it many times, but we decided to really just map it out almost like a diary. And what we decided to stick to was just after school. She actually had some weekend conflicts and before school issues with child care. And, you know, just to step back for 1 minute before I speak about Emily, if we reflect on the fact that we pay tens of millions of our working people in this country, you know, less than less than $10 an hour, and that is the case in this country today, and we know what child care costs in America, because many of us have had to pay it or are paying it. We don't provide child care as a social program. We don't have that. We don't ensure that all children in this country are safe and have child care. So if we just recognize that, then we know that there are millions of Emilys out there, and that is there are millions of parents, millions of moms who don't have the money to purchase stable, routine child care. They just can't do it. It costs too much, and they don't make enough money. So what Emily told me about was she sort of went through Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and each day was a different kind of constellation of ways that she tried to keep her kids covered. One was they would go to a grandmother, but then they had to get on the public bus in order to get there. And the grandmother had diabetes. She'd actually had surgery on her foot. She couldn't meet them at the front door. So one of these two young kids, one was at the time was 9, the older child was 9, had to carry a key. She actually was carrying two keys, and so she had to make it into the apartment building, and sometimes the key didn't seem to work. These were just little tales in a way, and yet they represent the hardship that so many children are face. Another day, she actually could come up with no way to have the kids covered. No adult was available at all. And so they would stay at the school, and they would try to come up with ways to pretend that they had a reason to be at the school for an extra hour and a half, and they'd try to stay in the gym or in the hallway. But sooner or later, they would have to go outside, and rain or shine, they would hang around in the playground for an hour and a half until she could pick them up. And these are the kind of invisible but really eroding experiences that go on and simply aren't recorded, aren't sort of recognized as a mainstream part of American childhood now.
Yes, and they bring tears to your eyes, leaving the children on the playground, too. Yeah. I remember that. What if it rains?
Exactly. What if it rains, or what if her little brother? I mean, this is something that I don't know why this came to my mind, but, you know, I wondered, so what does she tell her little brother when he's, you know, he says he has to go to the bathroom, you know? And so she told me, well, she takes him by, this didn't go in the book, but she, you know, she takes him behind the building, tries to find a safe place, but that's the reality. Children have to go to the bathroom. Children need care.
Sure.
And if we don't pay people enough, we don't pay them a wage so they can purchase childcare, and we don't ensure that, you know, we have systems in place, then this is where we find them.
So many of the women talked about sending their children to school sick because they were going to lose their jobs if they took a day to be with their sick child.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And you know, the issue that always comes up is how irresponsible that is. And I did hear that, you know, sometimes in schools these teachers would, you know, they'd throw up their hands and they say, this child is so clearly ill. But a lot of the teachers also said, I know that she doesn't have any more sick days. She gets 3 a year. She has 2 children. And so if she keeps this child home, which is, we think, you know, the responsible thing to do, well, then she loses her job and she can't feed them and she loses her apartment. So what is the responsible thing to do? And that's why I think some of the teachers and also nurses will actually set up their own little quiet sick ward, and they will, instead of being angry at mom for not picking the child up, even though we'd all like that. I mean, of course, this child then is contagious, so other kids get sick.
Sure.
Yeah. No win.
So what is the responsible thing to do? I ask that in as broad a fashion as you want to take it.
Yeah.
It's...
Well, I think that was really the moral dilemma that emerged, that a lot of these middle-income people and teachers, as we're saying, nurses, but also even managers, employers, they looked at these parents or their children or the families, and a lot of them have families of their own, and they thought to themselves, just what would I do if those were my choices? You know, what is being a good parent? What is being a good worker? And what is ethical here? And am I, in fact, playing a role in this? And could I do something a little differently? And what that often meant was breaking a rule, bending a rule, in order to not punish a parent who's doing the best she can, but her choices are just non-existent.
Mm-hmm. And what about the employer? A lot of the businesses that you dealt with were restaurants or retail, small retail.
Yep.
They weren't, you know, huge corporations,
yep,
faceless corporations. They need their workers to be there on time.
Yep.
They need them to be there every day because their staffs are pretty slim. They don't have a lot of extra people on hand.
Mm-hmm.
How do they deal with, and how do we deal with, the fact that things happen in life, and you're not always going to be able to go to work, and the business might suffer?
Well, I think one thing that obviously I talk about throughout the whole book is if we paid people enough, if we paid people a living wage, a livelihood, not just a wage, they'd be in better shape in order to buy the kind of childcare that's available. But the other issue is flexibility at work, because those of us who are lucky enough to have a decent wage, we have family issues. They come up. We need some flexibility. I think that if companies invested in their employees and didn't make it a problem for the manager gets put in this position where, you know, she can't run the floor of her shop, or she can't keep the food coming out because she's low staffed. If we invested enough in our employees and our workforce, then there would be enough there. There would be alternatives for her. But I point to of the managers in the book. I point to one woman, Cora.
Yes.
She runs a franchise here in the Northeast, and what she decided to do was throw the rule book out the window and create her own. And basically, she sat down with her employees, most of whom were young moms, and she said to them, "If you can come up with a schedule that lets you take care of your kids and keeps the floor covered," they run a sort of upscale fast food restaurant. If you can do that, then I'm going to represent you as having fulfilled all your duties, your schedule. And she actually worked with the employees. They came up with their routines, which included coming in, leaving, coming back, leaving, coming back. They made sure that the floor was covered, and in the end, they ran things fine. She actually had the lowest turnover of a lot of the managers in the area, but she handed in a timesheet at the end of the month. She handed in a schedule that in no way represented, if you will, the truth, mm-hmm, the actual schedule of these people, because that was against the rules to let them do what they were doing.
Phone calls for you in just a moment. We're talking with the author of The Moral Underground, How Ordinary Americans Subvert an Unfair Economy. Lisa Dodson is our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now and start with, is it Jillian from Suamico?
Hello. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you and your guest. I wanted to tell you my life story.
Mm-hmm.
I was a white Catholic girl in a family of seven, graduated from high school in 72, and was told all my teen years that when you're 18, you're out of the house and on your own.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to go to college, but had no means at that time. There was no loans or programs like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I got married 2 months after high school, had a baby a year later, and then found out that my husband was unfaithful and lying, and I got beat up and divorced.
Oh.
So I went to job services to look for a job, and there was none. So they offered me this new federal program now, and this is the 73, mm-hmm. that they were able to provide one-year training at a technical school with assistance with their books, transportation, child care.
Mm-hmm.
However, the waiting period to get into those classes was 2 years. Mm-hmm. So because of my aptitude and grades, they bent their rules and allowed me to go to a four-year college, 2 years at my college, and then apply for a nursing school.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no money. I got $50 a month child support because my ex-husband left the town and quit his job. I had to walk probably more than 5 miles a day to the bus stop and around the campus with my two-year-old on my back.
Mm-hmm.
I finally graduated in 1980 from Bellin School of Nursing and received half scholarships and half loans. When I went back to show these federal workers my diploma, they all cried. They could not believe that I was able, with against all odds, to have accomplished this goal.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to say that if we could get rid of the corruption and employ more people in supervision, there is money out there to help everyone, whether they are totally poor or middle class. My two children are $50,000 in debts and loans for their college education.
Mm-hmm.
Lisa.
Well, first of all, Jillian, I just congratulations to you for, you know, making such a long road and, you know, to your credit. I also would say that Jillian's story is very familiar to me. You know, often the people who I've interviewed over the years are moms who've become single mothers and who are in the situation of having to not only manage economically for their family, but also obviously take care of their kids along the way, make sure that they're safe. I think that it's interesting, one of the points that you made early on, Jillian, was that that they bent the rules a little bit in order to give you access to a four-year college degree. And of course, there are very, very few people who graduate four-year college who end up needing to be on welfare or who end up indigent. On the other hand, you also point out that there needs to be a lot more of that kind of support, and, you know, your kids are running into this now or have already. And to me, it seems so absolutely obvious that if we invested in education for all of our people, Jillian and Jillian's children and their children, if we invested in education, they're absolutely prepared to walk 5 miles a day, as Jillian pointed out, in order to take care of themselves and to have a decent job and to take care of their own families.
Mm-hmm. Invest in education and also invest in child care.
Absolutely.
Oh my gosh, do we need that? And we've been talking about it forever, Lisa.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, we've been talking about it for years and decades. And, you know, if you look back, if you reflect back, there was a time, and that was during World War II, you may be familiar with this, but we actually as a country decided that because there were so many women, we needed to enter the workforce during that period. Men were abroad. They were in the military. And so we asked women to step up. It was out of character, not the habit of the country at the time, but we asked them to go to work and, in fact, provided poured resources into child care so that they could, and it was good child care, and it worked. It's not as though we don't know how to do this. It is very much a decision about what we want to invest our
mm-hmm.
funds into.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Jillian, for your call. We go to Frank from Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, this is a very fine guest and a very important topic. If I may, one of the parables that I really appreciate is that of Samaritan.
Mm-hmm.
And but that type of personal virtue
mm-hmm.
Only goes so far.
Mm-hmm.
And we live in an age where it's the Pharisee who passed on the other side
mm-hmm.
who's considered virtuous.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would like to ask the guest, she was once a union organizer.
Yeah.
To a certain degree, what we need is a type of social justice and citizenship that says that access to education, a living wage, medical care are rights, not privileges to be given only to some who we consider virtuous. So it's personal virtue is quite good, but I think solidarity and an emphasis on social and economic justice for everyone is essential. And we should be challenging people who I think have come to consider themselves our rulers about that. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Frank, as always.
Yeah, if I may respond to what Frank said, I'm very glad he made this point because, you know, in writing this book, one of my intentions was really shining a light on what I see as a deep part of the American character, and that is to stand up when as individuals when they see a situation that is just profoundly unjust. And in this case, I see these are acts of economic disobedience. They're not civil disobedience, but we have a deep, long history of that. But the point that Frank makes, and that is that individual acts of these kind, they're very important to notice, to recognize, to see happen everywhere, but they will not shift the economy. The only way that the economy will really shift is if all of these people recognize that we have this as a shared concern. He used the word solidarity, wonderful word, and that this is best for the nation. So it has to be a really a structural change, not just individual acts.
You know, I don't want to be too simplistic about this, but somehow the fact that this is the week when Wall Street is going to be handing out huge, huge bonuses after they went bankrupt and we gave them our money. We gave them our money. What about giving our money for what you were just talking about? Is this too simple a way to look at this, or this must play in some way, doesn't it? Economic disparity?
Well, you know, I don't, you know, maybe it is simple, but I'm with you on this, Kathleen. I mean, I think that if we can come up with $700 billion because we look at the situation, economic situation, say this is really shaky. It's shaking us up. Then I would say let's look at the economic situation of so many of our people and recognize how shaky it has been, already has been, and is. But also, let's look at the situation of our children, again, to go back to the child care issue, the health care issue, college issue, kids, you know, our young people, we want them to continue to be educated, and talk about investing in that on equal terms. And to me, the return is just so obviously so great, so long-lasting. So I'm with you on that.
Let's go to another caller. Hello, you're on the air. Hi.
Yeah. Let me come at this from a different perspective. And I deal with the nuts and bolts of this every day. And in the position that I hold, which is a managerial position, I bend over backwards every day because I see the fright in the eyes of people.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can, you know, fudge the system in their favor, I do it constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of have a feeling that probably a lot of that goes on.
Yep.
I found myself in positions in which I really can't afford it, but, you know, sometimes I've lent money to pay for doctor bills and things like that. And And then you hear the other side, you know, the comment that was just made about Wall Street, which is just absolutely disgusting. I mean, people are brainless. Above all, I think we're human beings, and we should act as human beings.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I just want to really commend you. You know, I think it's one of the elements of doing this research that I found was that people had to be very hesitant to tell me the accounts of what they were doing. You know, the term that the caller just used was fudging. You know, I heard the term of, well, sort of under the radar, look the other way, fudging. And really what these are, again, I call them acts of economic disobedience, but they're just acts of being humane, of recognizing the humanity of the people who work for you and wanting to be a fair man, a fair woman, a fair person in this society. But it is difficult to acknowledge that because, of course, it can be received as, can be looked upon as, you know, as people express to me that I'm cheating the system, you know, and that's often a term that's used. So it takes some courage, I think, to act on your convictions.
Tell us some of the stories. There are so many in the book, but the stories of people who were working in the food industry and food was made for them and their families mm-hmm. to take home, or they were allowed to eat their yep. meals, because that can be an expense for families, and managers realize that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, depending on what industry we were looking at, and the food industry is, it hires a lot of low-wage workers. And then healthcare is another one. A lot of low-income people work in different kinds of healthcare. And so depending on the industry and what managers had access to help people out, they'd try to make the most of it. If they made this decision that they were going to, if they were actually going to stand up for, in these quiet ways, the people who work for them. And one of the ways in the food industry, particularly at, this was in grocery store, where not only the grocery stores themselves, but food is transported, of course, all over the country. And one element of this is that if food is in some way, if the packaging is damaged or cans are dented or other kinds of ways in which the food is not not up to absolute par, or at least the claim can be made that the food is not up to par, then this was a way to divert some of it into grocery bags that that would find their way into the hands of people working in the food industry, you know, for years and years, and yet are unable to buy enough food for their children. So that was one example that I heard in numerous places around the country.
And the prom dress, many will yeah. identify with this story.
Yeah, well, yeah, Bee was just, I call her Bee in the book. Her story was particularly moving to me because she was a manager of a very large, it's a well-known big box store around the country, and she was a manager, and she was proud of being a manager. She had a lot of people working for her. But she told me the account of a woman who I call Nancy, who had a daughter, and Bee knew her daughter too. Her daughter used to come and work part-time at the store as well. And so Edie, the name of the daughter, had worked very hard, and she was graduating from high school. And Nancy one day told Bee that she just simply could not afford to buy her daughter a prom dress to go to the prom. And Bee thought about this. She just thought about the idea of this woman she'd known working so hard, doing the job the way she's supposed to, her daughter working really hard to get through high school. And this moment, you know, a moment of joy for the family, a moment they wanted to celebrate together, was going to be taken away as far as she was concerned. She wouldn't go to the prom if she couldn't look really, really good. It was that important to her. And so as Bee explained it to me, well, what she asked me at that point was, she said, did I notice that they sell prom dresses at the store? And then she told me that prom dresses come in and they go out and they get put on layaway and some get returned and some get picked up, and sometimes one can slip through the mm-hmm. net there. And mm-hmm. So, in fact, this young woman had a prom dress for her prom.
And she looked fabulous.
Right? And she looked fabulous. She knocked them dead. That's what Bee said.
I like that comment. Yeah. More phone calls in just a moment. We're speaking this hour with Lisa Dodson. Lisa is the director of the, well, has been the director of the Division of Women's Health for the state of Massachusetts. She's worked as a union activist and obstetrical nurse. She is now professor of sociology at Boston College. The Moral Underground is her book. How Ordinary Americans Subvert an Unfair Economy. And we're welcoming phone calls for her. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you want to send an email message, that's talk@wpr.org. If we don't get, you know, I was just thinking about this. I think we can accomplish this. If we don't get to all of your emails, we missed many of them last hour. We're going to post some of those on our Facebook page, because it's a way to, I know that all of you don't call in, certainly, but you're thinking about these issues, and they're fairly important issues, and it's good to keep the conversation going. So we're on Facebook now. I've grown to become very fond of Facebook. So go to the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we'll post some of the first hour comments and second hour comments as well for you. Okay, back to phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to Joe now from Madison. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Hi.
I was a supervisor a long time in a call center environment, and I know exactly what you're talking about. I've had many theories through the years, and sometimes you have to, as the previous caller stated, fudge the the numbers or whatever you have to do because, whether it's attendance policies or performance statistics or, they're constantly manipulated to squeeze out the last drop of blood from people. And when anybody has a weakness in their life, a family matter, a health issue, whatever, especially in a non-union environment, I mean, it's just a matter of time before someone comes after you. And I eventually just couldn't handle it anymore, my own sense of right and wrong. But through the years, I've my own theory on this has been that I think that the anonymous ownership of the stockholders, and I think there's a, cut this number by X amount and make it happen. It comes down to a supervisor like I was, and then here's how we're going to do it. And it's just almost, it's a lot easier to be predatory if you don't have to look somebody in the eye. That's what I always thought. And I'm not sure there'll ever be a fix for that, but it's a problem. I mean, I think there's a book out called Bad Money by Kevin Phillips, and he talks about this too, where the workplace today, I mean, if you're a good employer, it's hard to stay in business, and some places resort to this type of predatory and just inhumane treatment, and that's my only comment.
So when you say, Joe, you couldn't handle it, what did you do? You left, and what do you do?
Well, I mean, I eventually, had a chance to leave, and I did. It wasn't, and it wasn't a hard decision, that's for sure, but I think that I think there's a lot of managers. It wasn't just me.
Yeah.
I mean, we're all human, and we realize when we look at each other that this is clearly wrong.
Yeah.
And it's a real ethical dilemma for a lot of frontline supervisors and middle managers. And you, on the one hand, you have your own house mortgage to worry about.
Yep.
And on the other hand, you realize what you're doing to this person is just unjustifiable.
Yeah. Professor Dodson.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that, Joe, that's just a, perfect description of what I kept hearing. And, I think that the face-to-faceness, the proximity really is extremely important. You look in the face of someone and you can see yourself in their eyes. If you were in their situation, you couldn't take care of your children. You didn't have enough money at the end of the week after working hard. But I think that that's one of the reasons for writing this book was I wanted to point out how many people feel precisely as you feel, that in fact this, we don't hear enough about this. We hear about the predators, and there are many of them, or at least there's a few, but they're very, very powerful. And they would have us believe that being predatory is the culture of our people. That's who we are. And part of the whole reason of writing this book and wanting to speak to people like you and encourage other people all over was to say, no, that actually doesn't represent the ordinary Americans. In fact, I found that most people, most ordinary people, middle-income people, working-class people, they really don't want to behave in that way. They don't want to go home at the end of the day and think about how they squeezed, as you put it, squeezed the last drop out of people and didn't pay them enough to take care of their own families. I found that the majority of people really would like it to be a much more fair economy. And so I kind of want to raise that conversation up because it's been kind of kept in corners because people have to fudge it and have to kind of hide what they're doing. And I think it's time for us to speak more out loud about it. I appreciate your call.
And if we do speak more out loud, if we hear from more people like that, what's the result?
Well, I think initially the result to me is that those of us who feel that way, and there are many, we realize that we are the majority. That in fact, and the majority, of course, when we recognize that we are the majority, I actually probably the vast majority, that we can maybe turn around then and say, you know what, we want to shift this. We want to take back some of that that distribution of wealth that is so over, you know, so heavy on top. That ought to be shifted back down. That ought to be shifted into child care and health care and into wages, you know, and into treating people who are doing their jobs decently to have enough money as well so that they can take care of their own families. So I think that when we recognize that this is really the majority perspective in this country, I think we might be more bold about expecting more and also taking more from the corporate wealth.
Thanks, Joe. Tom is next from Burlington. Hi.
From the point of view of a single parent mother, my father died when I was 14 and the youngest was 3.
Mm-hmm.
She had 8 children. And she raised them all herself.
Mm-hmm.
And from what you're saying, I look at things from the trying to help the single-parent mother.
Yes, yeah.
And now we have the bonuses on the East Coast this week, and we have this marriage, yep, in a gay marriage in a courtroom on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always said on this show many times, and I may be a bored Catherine, my question was, why can't two single-parent mothers create a two-parent family unit for the benefit of the mothers, children, and the taxpayers paying for schools that are failing and jails that are filling up? And I just wonder what, maybe you're coming from Massachusetts where you do have civil unions and you have a broader picture on the idea of same-sex marriage. I wonder what your views are as far as helping the single-parent mothers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that families, first and foremost, children need parents. They need people to take care of them, and they need people who aren't working in jobs that take all their time away. And that's one of the things in the book. I found so many stories of in many cases, single moms who worked had to work so many hours because their wages were so low that they could not spend enough time with their children. And, of course, there are grave effects from that. As far as I'm concerned, you know, two parents make it's a much stronger, much greater possibility for children to have the attention they need if they have more adults in their life who love them and have a healthy and strong union. And so I'm all for, you know, the two-parent families, gay two-parent families or man and woman two-parent families, civil unions. I'm all for that. But I think that the way that we pay people, it has an enormous impact on children, regardless of the structure or the construction of the marriage. We need to pay people a living wage. We need to pay them a family wage, and that way they can take care of their children.
It is. I was just thinking about how different everything is, Lisa, from the time when I was a kid when Mom was home. She worked part-time, but she was home.
That's right.
And it makes a huge difference just to, when you have two people working and you have even one child or more than one child, oh, my gosh, it's almost impossible for one person to take all that on.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. I some of the stories that, for me, were the most difficult to listen to, and I was a single parent for a number of years, listening to stories of, in one case, a dad, and most cases, moms, talking about how hard they were trying to stay up with their children's lives and be with them and hear what was going on. You know, kids come home, they want to talk about what was going on every day and the problems and their triumphs, too. And a number of people who I interviewed actually work 2 full-time shifts.
Oh, goodness.
In order to, you know, if you make 8 hours and you can barely scrape by in $16 an hour, then you work 2 shifts. And basically they were spending 5 hours at home a day and so exhausted they couldn't even talk to their children. Yeah.
It makes you must have been exhausted hearing those stories.
Yeah, it just, the way I try to do this kind of work is I try to, I try to actually be a chauffeur for people like this, so I'll pick up somebody from their job and drive them to their next job and interview them in the car in between. And yeah, to me, it's just profoundly unjust, and we can do better. We are a very wealthy nation. We can treat our people better.
Right. And what about for you? Did you have help? Did you have good child care available to you just because you were doing a little better, not a whole lot probably, but a little better economically? How did you handle being a single mom?
Well, I was on my own with my child, and I carried it myself, but I was lucky enough to have a college education. I'm sort of thinking back to Jillian now, our first caller, had a college education. I was able to make a wage. We struggled, but I was able to afford to rent and food and what we needed to get by. And I also put, it's probably about 25% of my income into good child care for my child.
Yes.
She was in child care long, long hours, and it was not easy. But I knew every day, I knew that the only reason why I could keep her safe and that we had, and I went was going back to school, the only reason I could do that was that I was being paid a wage that made it possible.
Right. Thanks, Tom, for your call. James from New Berlin. Hi.
Hi there. First of all, Lisa, I'm also from Massachusetts, and I have a degree in sociology. But right now I'm a regional manager for an upscale restaurant chain.
Uh-huh.
I work in four different states. And this Thanksgiving, we're presented with a couple of situations by some managers from a couple of our locations regarding some single mothers who were really, really struggling, getting as many hours in as they could.
Yep.
Just for, you know, trying to support these families. And the three cases that we personally looked at were each person had three children, and they were single mothers, and they were doing, you know, again, as best they could.
Yeah.
So what my partner and I did was we had after the Thanksgiving dinner on Thanksgiving evening, we had a family night where we invited these three families in and treated them to a meal as if they were the the customer.
Yeah.
And the owner of our company found out about this and actually called us down to Tennessee for a meeting.
Oh.
And because our meals were going for $29.99 a person on Thanksgiving. And so, you know, this is like $500 that the company ate, more or less, for this. Well, he was very upset at first. We, of course, offered to pay for it, et cetera. And after listening to the story of these three people, our restaurant chain now has employee appreciation family night.
Oh, great.
After dinner on Thanksgiving evening.
Wonderful.
And that will be for anybody who requests it and shows some type of need for it. And
it's a wonderful,
you know, it really made me feel good that our owner decided to see it our way about this. But it was a very fulfilling evening, and it was very nice.
Yeah.
And yeah, we broke the rules to do it, but I would do it again, you know.
Well, there you go, you know, and I just really want to say, you know, I want to commend you. I think it was, and I think it did take your courage and the two other people you mentioned to say, no, we're going to do it our way. And even if that way is breaking the rules, it's the decent way to do it. It's a way to treat people. And by doing that, by kind of creating that, what you did was you actually shifted something that was even larger. So I certainly, you know, good for you.
And how often do you hear, if ever, stories where it didn't work out that way, where people may have lost their jobs because of their acts of human kindness?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you, more than hearing that, because generally the people who I interviewed were people who were currently in those jobs. But what happened for me was that I collected, you know, just on your station just now, I mean, on the show, you just collected a bunch of wonderful accounts, right? I collected a whole lot of stories, which then I sat down with the person I interviewed and went over it and said, you know, this is what I want to put in my book. And in a lot of cases, what they said was to me was, I'm sorry, I've changed my mind. You can't put it in your book. And it wasn't so much that they were afraid that they were going to be fired. They were going to be identified and reprimanded or fired. But what it was a recognition that if I made public some of the strategies, I mean, in the case of that last caller, it was made public, and there was a jeopardy there, you know, but in the end, it went the other way. What they were saying to me is that if you make this public, this way that we, for example, one of them that I was not able to get into the book was a way somebody was managing to get heating fuel to people whose houses were cold because they couldn't afford it. And in the end of that story, I was, you know, he said, I just can't have you put that in your book because once you do, this way of doing this will be exposed.
Right.
So sometimes it was protecting a strategy, as well as protecting individuals.
Mm-hmm. Lisa, thank you so much for doing this book. I was really looking forward to speaking with you, and it has not been a disappointment, to say the least. Thank you so much.
Well, I really appreciate your having me on your show. Thank you.
Yes, our pleasure. Lisa Dodson, the book is The Moral Underground, How Ordinary Americans Subvert an Unfair Economy, published by The New Press. Thanks to all of your calls, everybody, too. Rhonda Fanning produced the program. Thanks, Rhonda. John Treader, our on-air producer here in downtown Milwaukee. Thank you, John. And thanks for all of your calls. We are on Facebook. We're going to try to put some of your comments on Facebook after we get off the air here. So it's The Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook. Until tomorrow, this is the Ideas Network.